You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Here's the thing, guys. If you're into fantasy football, DraftKings.com is the mother of all fantasy football websites. Now, I haven't done a survey. I don't have empirical evidence of that. But I'm telling you right now, it's not only the mother, it's, well, the king of all fantasy football websites. DraftKings.com. One-way fantasy means no season-long commitments. You play whenever you want. If you got an injured player, it's not a problem. It's like a new season every week, so you're never stuck with the same players. You pick your team in minutes, and you could be on your way to winning instant cash. Hurry and get free entry into the $100,000, I'll say it again, $100,000 fantasy football contest this weekend, where first place takes home, hold, $10,000. Whoa, that was an echo. Head to DraftKings.com now and enter code Callen. That's my last name, C-A-L-L-E-N, the host of the mother of all podcasts. And you get to play for free if you do that. So go to DraftKings.com, enter code Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, and you get to play for free. DraftKings.com, bigger events, bigger winnings, bigger millionaires. Not that they're heavier, just they're bigger somehow. Enter Callen for free entry now at DraftKings.com. I said it again, DraftKings.com. And now, back to the podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Callen here. I am very happy to have our guest is retired Lieutenant Colonel John Noggle. He's a retired Lieutenant Colonel of the U.S. Army, a graduate of West Point, and a Rhodes Scholar, which means he got his PhD from St. Anthony's College, Oxford. Or Oxford, as they say.
Oh, wow.
You see that? That's right. Of course, yes. Yes, in Oxford, of course, yes. I say, old boy. And he also wrote the thesis on counterinsurgency in Malaya, which is now Malaysia, and Vietnam. Served as military assistant to the Deputy Secretaries of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, and Gordon England, where he co-authored the U.S. Army and Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual with Generals David Petraeus, James Mattis. If you are in the military, you know John Noggle's name. He is the former president of the Center for the New American Security and the ninth headmaster of the Haverford School of Pennsylvania. So that now I say to myself, you know, do I call him John? Do I call him Lieutenant Colonel? Do I call him, a headmaster? I'm just going to call you DT for deep thinker. DT Noggle, ladies and gentlemen.
If you change to ST for shallow thinker, I'll know the interview isn't going well.
Exactly. Well, if you disagree with me, that's what will happen. Listen, this is, we read both these books, Knife Fights and How to Eat Soup, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, Lessons.
There's a theme here.
And you got your eureka moment. I think you're reading T. Lawrence's memoirs on what it was like to sort of lead this band of Arab guerrillas against the Ottoman Empire or Ottoman,
Yes. And you really did read it. This is impressive.
Oh no! Listen, we read the books here, and these books deserve to be read. And you're going to have a lot of time to talk. But one of the reasons that I take what you have to say so seriously. And put a lot of effort into this is because there are a lot of men and women, Americans and Iraqi, but let's talk about Americans as well, who lost their lives, who lost their limbs, who lost marriages and everything else. There was a lot of sacrifice. And when you look at the Iraqi landscape now, if you look at the Middle East, if you look at what we went in there to try to fix, it in many ways has gotten worse. At least in pockets of Iraq, and I'm trying to be fair to the effort, and I think that's
very fair. I think it's gotten appreciably worse.
Yes,
and preventably so.
Yes, and I just read Fiasco.
That's uplifting.
It sure is. But these are very important. And rather than, Hunter and I always talk about, you can get in these things where you start pointing fingers. I wish you had had a megaphone, and I wish you had been talking to all the guys at the American Enterprise Institute Irving Kristol and Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz, who I'm sure you know, and for that matter, Dick Cheney. And I thought it was very telling that most of the people that were calling for an invasion in Iraq had never done a day of military service. Listen, we have a civilian government, and that's a good thing. But
well, and I think that's, again, Brian and I were arguing about this before the podcast, but let's just even start off with, you know, what was your journey, the journey that you lay out in Knife Fights, right? What was it that first started you thinking about counterinsurgency?
And before you answer that, we should also say you were not in favor of an Iraq invasion.
I was not in favor of the Iraq invasion of 2003. I was in favor of the Iraq invasion of 1991, Operation Desert Storm, of which I was a part.
Yes, sir.
So Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, did horrible things to Kuwait in 1990. The international community said this will not stand under George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, in my eyes, the best president of my lifetime. We very rapidly, in 100 hours, we turned the Iraqi army from the fourth largest in the world to the second largest in Iraq. We liberated Kuwait. We did something, quite frankly, that I think the United States can be proud of in the Middle East. Those are few and far between, so when it happens, let's underline it. But it was as a result of that experience of fighting an Iraqi army. I was a tank platoon leader in the U.S. Army's 1st Cavalry Division, mounted on an M1 A1 tank, and we literally cut through the Iraqi army like a hot knife through butter. And I became convinced as I reflected on that experience afterwards that no one would ever give us the opportunity to do that again, that no one looking to fight the United States after Operation Desert Storm would say, hey, it's a good idea to fight them tank on tank, plane on plane. We'll really do well against them. We are an overwhelming conventional military force. And so the eureka moment you described came when I was back at Oxford working on my doctorate, not on the conventional kind of war that I just fought in, tank on tank kind of warfare, but a different kind of war, a war of insurgency and terror, a war where our enemies refuse to face us in open combat because they know they'll be slaughtered. Instead, they live as fish swimming in the sea of the people, to use Mao's phrase. They don't wear uniforms. They fight us with ambushes and with improvised explosive devices and with booby traps and with snipers. And it's an entirely different kind of war. And that, I thought, after Desert Storm was the kind of war we were likely to see in the future, precisely because we had been so successful in Desert Storm.
And that's not the kind of war that most people were expecting, right? I mean, it's important for us to remember in the 90s where the military's focus was.
No, we after kicking butt and taking names in Desert Storm, we spent the next decade working hard to get even better for the next time we had to fight Desert Storm, not recognizing, not looking at the battlefield from the enemy side of the hill, and recognizing that anybody would have to be crazy to line their tanks up and let us do that to them again. And so it's literally true that I was on my tank, engaged in a simulated tank-on-tank battle, when we got the call in the fall of 2003, after the unnecessary invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, we got the call that told us we were going to Iraq to fight a very different kind of war, and we were 180 degrees out. We were preparing for a conventional war. We had done no preparation for an irregular war, but an irregular war is what we had to fight, and boy, it was a tough fight.
But wasn't that because, and this is what I got from Fiasco and having lived in the Middle East myself for 8 years, I knew that when they did a poll, I think they asked everybody in Congress that they knew the difference between a Shia and a Sunni. Now I knew that because I had lived in Saudi Arabia and Lebanon, and then I started to notice that it seemed like the architects of the Iraq War, the people like Richard Pearl or Paul Wolfowitz, etc., they just didn't seem to really know how that country was structured. They didn't seem to know anything about the history of that country. And I don't know if I'm being unfair, but I just felt like these were academic people who had the idea that we could bring democracy to the Middle East. And
yeah, but Professor Nagel is also an academic. Like, let's not make it about academics versus practical experience.
What I'm saying, what bothered me, though, and correct me if I'm wrong, professor, they just didn't seem to really do enough investigation into how that country was structured, and more importantly, the history of that country. And so we came in there with this, with a very different approach than we should have. Is that fair?
The last part is certainly true, that we came in with a very different approach than we should have. Paul Wolfowitz, I actually became friendly with. I worked for him for about 18 months in the Pentagon. Paul actually did understand, Paul, a very smart academic, did understand the Sunni-Shia split in Iraq. He was dating a Shiite Iraqi and felt that, correctly, that the Shiites had been horribly repressed by Saddam Hussein mm-hmm. and his Ba'athist regime. He did not properly think through, I don't think, and he had a lot of company in this, did not think through what was likely to happen when we overturned the order in Iraq. The Iraq had been ruled by Sunnis for 75 years since the Brits put them in power in the years after the First World War. When we imposed democracy on Iraq, the Sunnis were not going to be happy about that, and a minority of the population who was used to having a majority of the power were not going to stand idly by when their world was turned upside down by American intervention. And so the Sunnis fought back hard, first against us as the occupiers and the invaders, fighting against their forces, and then against the Shiite government of Iraq that we gradually stood up over time.
And to interrupt you for a second, that was a surprise to a lot of people who were involved in
and it shouldn't have been.
That's what I'm saying. Because we were told about that, weren't we? I mean,
yeah. My friend Conrad Crane, who ended up being the lead editor for the project to write the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual, under the supervision of David Petraeus and U.S. Marine Corps General Jim Mattis. Con Crane wrote a paper in 2002 with Andy Terrell that said, hey, if we invade Iraq, we're likely to set off an ethnic firestorm. It's going to take hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops to police the aftermath of that for a generation. And Con Crane, smart guy, knew what he was talking about. Absolutely no response to his policy paper. And so the decision to invade Iraq, the unnecessary decision to invade Iraq in March of 2003, Tom Ricks opens his book Fiasco that you've mentioned, saying that invasion was probably the most profligate act ever committed by any nation in history. That's how bad of a decision that was. Really, really not so good.
Wow.
And if you go back to, I mean, that's the other thing. Like, even, I mean, there's the 2002 paper, but let's go back to the 91 Iraq War. There's a reason why George H.W. Bush stopped 100 miles outside of Baghdad.
And his defense secretary, the Honorable Richard Cheney, advised him not to go on to Baghdad.
Right.
And so one of
really?
The one of the
really?
One of the yeah, absolutely. So one of the really interesting questions is what happened to Dick Cheney between his extraordinary service as a Secretary of Defense during Operation Desert Storm, the first Gulf War, and a decade later when he decided it did make sense now.
Well,
Tom
Ricks actually even asked that question in Fiasco, and he says maybe it was his heart condition. Maybe he's puzzled by Cheney's about face.
And Brent Scowcroft, who was as close to George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, as anybody, they co-wrote their memoirs together. A wonderful Brent Scowcroft, National Security Advisor of the United States, he said, in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, Scowcroft was very visibly and publicly arguing against it in the pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post, and he says, this Dick Cheney, this the Vice President Dick Cheney, I don't even recognize. This is not the guy I used to know when I was the National Security Advisor and he was the SecDef.
Wow. Do you think it was hubris? Do you think it was...
Many people have suggested that that something happened to Dick Cheney on an operating table. When you have open heart surgery, when they stop your heart, personality changes can result. Things happen.
Wow.
But the role of Dick Cheney as a moderating element and a very responsible, very good Secretary of Defense in my eyes in 1991, and a vice president who I think made absolutely the wrong decisions in the run-up to the war in Iraq, that really matters. That difference really matters.
But then, so let me ask you, as far as the people that were really pulling the strings, and again, we have to resist saying these were the bad guys, because I think people like Paul Wolfowitz were.
These are all great Americans trying to keep the country safe after a horrible attack on the United States on September 11th, and we forget now, almost immediately following, a completely unconnected anthrax attack across the U.S. Capitol, across Washington.
That's right.
The concern about the next strike was real and pervasive, and they wanted to do anything they could to keep the country safe.
And so I
don't doubt their motives. I do doubt some of their. I disagree with some of their decisions. Mm.
And more importantly, the public was broadly behind it. I mean, you know, the thing that I think the U.S. public has done most is to distance themselves from what they wanted in 2003 and to pretend like they had the foresight that you actually did have.
I think it's the doctoral dissertations will be written on this decision for decades and decades to come. One of the interesting things is that a bunch of political scientists, students of international relations, took out full-page ads in the New York Times saying, don't do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
100 best international relations scholars America has to offer say, don't do this. But you're absolutely right, right? You know, then-Senator Hillary Clinton voted in favor of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, a vote that she will regret on her deathbed, probably the biggest mistake of her political career.
And hopefully she will regret when she runs for president in 2016.
Do you think she's going to? I haven't heard that.
Well, you know.
I think
that's the thing. And I mean, this is why, you know, I mean, I felt when 9/11 happened, I felt a profound sense of dread because, like Brian, I had lived internationally. And, you know, my father had been a target of November 17th, which was a terrorist organization in Greece. And then I was in Britain in the 90s as the IRA and the UFF and the UVF were facing off. And so, you know, in a sort of very naive, unstructured way, I understood that primarily terrorism was about public relations. It was about psychology. It was about, you know, all of the sort of political goals. And so when I ultimately read Learning How to Eat Soup with a Knife, you know, you gave articulation to things that I had only sort of vaguely felt, that there really are, we can't, the strategy of thinking that you can simply annihilate any enemy is not correct. That's a far too simplistic view of the world.
Soft power, unfortunately,
it's that belief dominated the first 6 years of the George W. Bush administration, and I think led to us creating a lot of enemies that we didn't need to in the wake of September 11th.
So just to work through your work, like, let's start with, you know, the counterinsurgency lessons that come out of Malaya and Vietnam, which is, you know, learning how to eat soup with a knife. Like, what was the difference between the Malaya experience, which was one of the few successful counterinsurgencies, and then Vietnam?
So it's important to emphasize right off the top that the two wars are very, very different, and that in a lot of ways, Malaya was a whole lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and for our listeners, Malaya is now Malaysia, I think,
correct.
Singapore and the areas around there.
Right.
Correct. Singapore was part of Malaya when Malaya became Malaysia. Singapore became an independent and very interesting country.
And give us the years. Give us the years for the British.
So from 1948 to 1960, so right in the wake of the Second World War, Malaya had been occupied by the Japanese during the Second World War. That upset the pre-war colonial order. And in the wake of the Japanese occupation of Malaya, a number of mostly ethnic Chinese fought against the reimposition of the pre-war colonial order. And so they fought against the British. Occupation is too strong of a word, but the British colonial leadership, government, planters, farmers, miners. The Brits started badly in their response, as conventional armies tend to do when they're fighting insurgents. They tried to respond with overwhelming force. It didn't work. They didn't have any real intelligence to tell them who the enemy were amidst the mass of the population. But the British Army adapted and learned, had some real decisive leadership in a man named Gerald Templer, who later earned the title the Tiger of Malaya, and succeeded in what is widely viewed as the classic case of successful Western counterinsurgency in the 20th century. But they had some natural advantages. Malaya was a peninsula, which is a whole lot easier. There wasn't a whole lot of infiltration from other countries. The insurgents didn't have safe areas they could go into, cross international borders, and be safe in another country. Almost all of the insurgents were ethnic Chinese who were easily visually identifiable, separate from the majority of the population, which was Malay. And CNN hadn't been invented yet. So the Brits were able to conduct their counterterrorism campaign very far from the unblinking eye of the global media. And so they took
they could be pretty brutal if they wanted.
They could be pretty brutal, yeah. And were. And they created concentration camps, essentially, moved the Chinese out of their villages, moved them into concentration camps, and exercised food control inside those concentration camps so that the communist terrorists living out in the jungle, they essentially starved them out.
And in terms of that food control, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that they cooked all of the rice on site. So they didn't give the Malays uncooked rice because if it's cooked, it has a shelf life and you can't
Correct.
Pass it on to the insurgents.
And so when you talk to British veterans of the Malayan emergency, as I did when I was writing the book, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, they talk about very skinny, very hungry insurgents surrendering, coming out of the jungle because of the effectiveness of the food denial operations.
All
things that we couldn't even dream of doing in a counterinsurgency campaign today were absolutely the stock in trade of the Brits in Malaya.
But there were things that they did do that we could do today. I mean, you know, one of the, I love the flyer about, you know, where they passed out this flyer of showing, look at this baby born in a safe, comfortable hospital, and then targeted, I think, a specific woman to make her abandon the guerrilla cause and come in for the sake of her baby and have a hospital delivery.
Yeah. And doing that requires a degree of intelligence that is arguably the true key to defeating any insurgency. And so the second chapter, I believe, of the counterinsurgency field manual I later helped write is intelligence. It's the longest chapter in the book, and it starts with a quote from General Creighton Abrams, the American commander in the last part of Vietnam, who said, "Everything good that happens seems to start with good intelligence."
Mm-hmm.
And this was a problem we faced in Vietnam, we faced again in Iraq, we're facing today desperately in Syria, we faced in Afghanistan, continue to face in Afghanistan, is we have not had a good picture of who the enemy is or why they're fighting.
And to have good intelligence, you need trust, you need language skills, you need relationships, you need all of those things, right?
Absolutely right. And those are hard things to develop, and they're particularly hard things to develop when you keep rotating forces into and out of a campaign.
Oh, yeah, that's very true.
As we continually do. So one line of analysis states that the United States Army didn't fight a 12-year war in Vietnam. It fought 12 one-year wars.
Hmm.
You know, one of the things that I wish, and it's hindsight, but what was highlighted not only in your work but also in Fiasco was how when you come into, you know, you got a special forces team or you've got a bunch of Marines or whatever it might be, or infantry, and they break into a house in a culture like Iraq, in a culture like Afghanistan, and they're looking for weapons and one of their buddies has been killed. These kids are angry. They're trying to make themselves and their buddies safer. And
they're scared.
They're scared and everything else. They put their foot on a guy's head. They handcuff him. His kids are crying. His wife is crying. And then they search the place and they leave. That just created a blood debt. You just created an insurgent because in his culture, now he's got to pick up a gun and for his own honor, shoot at you.
But hold on.
I'm just saying.
Is it just his culture, though? Because I think that was what was so interesting about Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife.
Good question.
The Mao's, you know, I don't remember what they were called, but like the three rules and the five principles or whatever the Mao's, what were those?
Mao had a series of rules for being an effective insurgent, and Mao, the most successful insurgent in history, overthrew the government of China because, in no small part, because he taught his insurgents to be respectful. As they were living off the kindness of the population as they were fish swimming in the sea of the Chinese population. He told them to do things like replace the door when you sleep in a house. So they would take the door off to create another bed, put it on sawhorses while people were staying in the house. You then be a good guest.
That's amazing, and coming from a major sociopath. I mean, that really is to have that kind of level of emotional and human understanding is
or
impressive.
To be that calculating.
But yeah. Hunter makes a good point.
And we did not have either that level of calculation or that level of empathy all too often. And so we created far more insurgents than we took off the battlefield in many places for many of the early years of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
But in Vietnam.
I'm very puzzled by Bremer's decision, or whoever's decision it was, and you can shed some light on this, to literally overnight fire, let's call it 500,000, mostly military people
mostly
in Iraq.
Mostly Sunni.
I mean, we just basically took, well, there are a lot of Shia actually in the Iraq army, but to say, hey, everybody, instead of what we did in Nazi Germany, which was fire the first three levels of command, we basically said, if you're a Ba'athist, quote unquote, you no longer have a job. So we'll see you later, everybody. And we fired the entire Iraqi military, all military men with weaponry who were, you know, proud guys who came steeped in a culture of honor and all that stuff. That's a good way to create an insurgency overnight.
If we had been trying to create an insurgency against us in Iraq in the fall of 2003, we literally couldn't have done any better.
Amazing.
And there's that.
But why? Can you shed some light on that colossal mistake?
What's that great line that you have that the Iraqi general, when he was surrendering, said to whoever he was surrendering?
So my buddy, later boss, Jeff Ingram, then Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Ingram, later colonel, was occupying part of Baghdad after the Thunder Run, after we toppled Saddam's government, and an Iraqi general, two-star general, came, reported to his headquarters, and was talking to Jeff and said, I've got my whole division, 10,000 guys. We all have our weapons. We all have our uniforms. We just took them off. We will come work for you. We will police the streets. We will prevent looting. We will keep Iraq safe and establish order and discipline. And my buddy said, dude, cool. That's better than my guys having to do it, and I've only got 500 guys. I'm a tank battalion. And they're having the conversations, and then Jeff got the orders down from Paul Bremer's office that we were disbanding the Iraqi army and never allowing them to work for the government again.
God.
And so he had to tell his Iraqi interlocutor, this Iraqi general, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you anymore. This isn't going to work. My government has made a different decision. And the Iraqi general was absolutely astonished, looked Jeff in the eye and said, you know this means I will be fighting you tomorrow. Jeff said, I know. They stood up, they saluted each other, and the next day the bomb started blowing up.
Wow.
So the degree of self-defeat, of what the British would call own goals, if this were a soccer game rather than deadly serious business, the damage we did to our own policy, the number of our own soldiers we put at risk, the degree of difficulty, already an enormously difficult task, remaking an Iraq that had been brutalized under more than 20 years of Saddam Hussein's leadership, all of that was already going to be super hard. But now, in addition to that, disbanding the Iraqi army rather than using it as a force for good, the most powerful instrument in that country at that time, was an unbelievably bad decision.
It was also historically ignorant. Who in the world... I'm just amazed that Paul Bremer or who was giving that order.
And so we don't know. Still today, we don't know. So Paul Bremer says it was Doug Feith's decision. Doug Feith and the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the number three job in the Pentagon. Feith says it was Bremer's decision. I find it hard to believe that Bremer would have made that decision independently within his first week on the ground in the Pentagon, within his first week on the ground in Iraq. So I believe that decision was made in the Pentagon. I believe it was made in Doug Feith's office. I believe it was an astoundingly bad decision that, you're absolutely right, was historically ignorant.
Yeah, Doug Fife in Fiasco is painted as just a guy who couldn't even run his own office.
He does not come off particularly well. I think that's a fair statement.
And it's not even, forget Doug Fife. I mean, if you're always going to have a guy who's just not good at his job or who's ignorant to the situation, what it matters in this discussion and in going forward in the future is figuring out a way to avoid these colossal mistakes.
And so perhaps it's a good time to talk a little bit about, having made these mistakes, the learning process that began first under General George Casey, the second American commander in Iraq after we toppled Saddam's government, but then in particular under General David Petraeus when he was assigned to take over responsibility for Iraq, having just spent a full year thinking through what his strategy would be if he were given the chance to go back to Iraq, and writing the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Manual, a process of which I was proud to be a part.
It's a great read, by the way, and available on Amazon.
Outstanding read and an important read.
Yeah.
U.S. Army military manuals.
I'm sorry, say that again, sir.
Military manuals are not known for being good reads, but this one was, fairly uniquely reviewed by the New York Times, favorably by the New York Times. We had the University of Chicago Press decided to publish it. I wrote a foreword for that edition, and I ended up taking the book on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, where I had, if you haven't seen the video, take a look, the funniest discussion Jon Stewart has ever had on camera about an Army field manual. I'm absolutely confident when I tell you that.
He's one of my favorite Americans. I love Jon Stewart.
He's astounding. He's recovering from food poisoning right now.
Oh, is he?
He is. But so he had to take a day off, but a night off. But really, and you know, talk about a lifetime stretch experience getting to be on the set of The Daily Show and talk to Jon Stewart, and tell an important story of the writing of a book that suggested a very different approach to the war in Iraq than the one we'd been taking to that point. And you've already, suggested some of the directions that the new manual went. So a focus on intelligence, a focus on not making more enemies, a focus on cultural awareness and cultural competence, on building political alliances inside the country in question, of continuous evaluation of your own operations and determining, right, if an operation takes one bomb maker off the battlefield but creates another 10 insurgents using the sort of tough techniques you talked about earlier, it's a net loss to us. More Americans are going to get killed, more innocent Iraqis are going to get killed rather than fewer as a result of that operation. And so the manual, really a pretty revolutionary, to the extent that a field manual, a military field manual, can be revolutionary, this one was. It told the military, was part of a process by which the military came to understand that in this century, we need to not just be able to defend against enemy attacks and attack the enemy ourselves, but also build a stable state in the wake of a conflict situation. And I actually believe that that task, that stability operations task, is going to be the most important thing we do over the next 50 years. It's something we failed to do sufficiently in Iraq, after that second war in Iraq, and that's why we're fighting another war in Iraq today, although we're not calling it a war. It's something we failed to do sufficiently in Afghanistan.
So here's my question. Who in the civilian government has read this? Who in the military government has read this? Has this permeated? Have these ideas taken hold in the minds of our decision makers? And are you optimistic that we will tackle this issue in Iraq? First of all, do you even think it's possible to make the situation better as an American, as a coalition, or leading a coalition? And do you think that that it's going to be adhered to? Do you think that we are going to fight these wars differently? We already are, to an extent.
We are fighting them differently. I'm afraid that the United States tends to lurch wildly from one extreme to another.
Yeah.
And so George W. Bush, Bush 43, I think for the first 6 years of his administration, used military force as the answer to pretty much every question. I think as Iraq went south pretty rapidly, he ultimately discovered that war was more complex, the world was more complex, and it required a greater degree of sophistication. Highlighted by the publication of the Counterinsurgency Field Manual, is replacing Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld with Robert Gates, probably the best appointment he ever made, and replacing George Casey with Dave Petraeus in Iraq in 2007. And Gates and Petraeus understood that war was different and required a gentler touch in some cases,
yep,
but a very firm very much a steel fist and a velvet glove. And that idea, I think, did permeate. Unfortunately, I think President Obama overlearned the lessons of George W. Bush's first 6 years. That is, Bush thought that military force was the only answer. Obama thought that military force was never the answer. And the fact is that there are bad people in the world, and sometimes they need to be killed. And by pulling all America, after Petraeus had really changed the course of the war in Iraq, convinced the Sunnis who had been fighting against us to start fighting with us against our common enemy of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a really remarkable change in war. I can only compare it to the turnaround in the Korean War under Ridgeway. So Petraeus and Gates, I think, created the conditions for a reasonable outcome in Iraq by 2010, 2011. The cost was far excessive to anything we accomplished. I am not saying the invasion of Iraq was a good idea. It wasn't. But they managed through changes in strategy, some of which we've talked about, building alliances with the Iraqi Sunnis to get us to a reasonable outcome there. But the president, President Obama, then fumbled the ball at the one-yard line. And failed to convert.
Where did he fumble? Did he fumble when he drew that red line and did nothing about it? When do you think he made the biggest fumble?
That was in Syria. That was also a fumble. That was a later fumble. In fact, yes. That may have been an interception. The easy win was in Iraq in 2011. His entire cabinet and all of his military advisors all advised him to leave a residual force in Iraq of some 15,000 American advisors to work with the Iraqi army to provide access to American air power and American intelligence for Iraq to keep pressure, keep leverage on Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki. Against the advice of all of them, and Secretary of Defense Panetta, who's on a book tour as well, has been really clear that he thought the president made a mistake here. I pretty strongly feel the president made a mistake here, said so at the time. The president decided to pull all Americans out of Iraq at the end of 2011. And so that allowed Al-Qaeda in Iraq to regain its footing. It allowed Maliki's worst sectarian influences, pro-Shia, anti-Sunni, to take hold in the Iraqi army, and it helped create a situation that led to the very rapid advances of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, across Iraq earlier this year.
I'm surprised that Obama didn't listen to that overwhelming advice. I mean, who else was in his ear? That's interesting to me.
The American people. I think so much of it is that, you know, it's very easy for us to talk about what the decision makers are doing, but we live in a democracy. And, you know, in 2003, the Americans wanted blood. We wanted vengeance. And then in 2011, we wanted Iraq to be over. Yeah. And to a certain extent, you know, it's rare to have a leader like Lincoln who, you know, has enough of a vision that he's not going to be totally swayed by polls from minute to minute to minute.
So I think that is certainly right. I'm actually looking at a picture of Lincoln, which I keep in my office. Lincoln was able to lead the American public. I disagree a little bit, though. I don't think while the American people were tired of the Iraq war. They would have told you that they wanted to be out of it. The intensity of their opinion was not very high by 2010, 2011. And it's an all-volunteer force. In the absence of a draft, the American people don't really, for better or for worse, are not as directly connected to the American military.
They were also mostly broke and dealing with the crash of 2008, 2009.
All true, yeah. But I will tell you that we've spent a whole lot more in the last 2 months of war in Iraq than we would have spent over the last 2 years keeping 15,000 advisors on the ground in Iraq and preventing this war from happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this really is a case where a stitch in time would have saved nine. And my hope, my most sincere hope, is that the president learns from this and doesn't make the same mistake in Afghanistan, where he also currently plans to pull all American advisors out from their service with the Afghan army at the end of 2017 before his term ends. If that happens, I am absolutely confident that the next president will have to go back into Afghanistan. By force. Let's not do that. Let's keep the advisors on the ground, right? And a point that I can't make often enough.
Define advisors. Green Berets, special forces teams.
So a core of Green Berets, which are special forces teams, so 12-man teams, who embed inside battalion and brigade-sized units and multiply the effectiveness of Iraqi army forces probably by a factor or two or three. And I am confident that with 10,000 American advisors working in the ministries in Baghdad, working inside all of the Iraqi army units, the Iraqi army would have stood firm against ISIS, and we would not have ISIS shelling Baghdad right now. Right, an extraordinary tragedy and an entirely preventable one.
Well, and also, I mean, this goes back to your point about American policy swinging from extreme to extreme, right? We had Vietnam, and then, you know, you talk about the Powell-Weinberger Doctrine, I think it is. Which is the response to that. Like, we overreact, and we're like, we never want another Vietnam again. So we're only going to do wars where, you know, certain conditions are met. And then, you know, Bush overreacts to that, and then Obama overreacts to that. You know, isn't it time that America started to figure out some sort of cohesive doctrine for foreign policy?
Or yes. The short answer is yes. My own belief is that the next president of the United States, who I believe will have one of three names, all of which are fairly famous in the American political spectrum, right? It's either going to be Clinton, Bush, or Romney in 2016. Any one of the three of them, I believe, would be more moderate, closer to what I consider to be the reasonable middle in terms of.
Well, hopefully they've read your work and had conversations with you. I'm not trying to pad your part here, but I'm being serious about that. Let me ask you a question. I put D.T. Noggle in deep thinker in the emperor's chair, and I say, here you go. You got all the resources you need. Fix Iraq. Fix Afghanistan. Tell me what you do. Sorry to put you on the spot.
So no, that's. I would love to be in that spot. And the answer isn't that hard. The really hard problem is actually Syria, and you didn't ask me to solve that.
Sorry.
But no, it's okay. I'll dodge that.
Let's go with Syria and Pakistan. If you want, to get crazy. you want to get crazy. You took the gloves off.
Pakistan is the hardest problem in the world.
It is.
Pakistan is much harder than Syria. So in order, Iraq is comparatively easy. We put 15,000 American boots on the ground. We embed American advisory teams inside every Iraqi battalion, inside every Kurdish battalion, and with that stiffening, with the increased effectiveness of air power, the increased effectiveness of ground power, those forces will be able to push ISIS out of Iraq over the next 2 years at the far end.
Isn't ISIS, is it primarily foreign fighters and disenfranchised remnants of the Iraqi army and partially some of the Syrian uprising?
It's all of the above.
Okay.
It's absolutely all of the above, but they're not particularly capable conventional fighters.
Okay.
Right. Their success has been more a function of the Iraqi army's weakness and the Iraqi government's weakness in the absence of American advice and support than it has been a reflection of their extraordinary fighting capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they aren't that hard to beat. Afghanistan is easier than that, right? We've gotten the Afghan army to a point, we've diminished the capability and effectiveness of the Taliban to such a point that by leaving behind the same sort of force, 15, 20,000 American advisors in Afghanistan, the Afghan army will be able to hold Afghanistan together. Now, we'll have to keep those American advisors in Afghanistan for a generation or two, but I'll remind you that we still have, four generations later, Americans in Germany, Italy, and Japan. Right, mm-hmm. Three generations later, American soldiers in Korea. When America fights a big war, we care enough to stay there to keep it from breaking out again.
Do you think we're going to do that in both cases? We didn't do that in Iraq.
So the president has been slowly getting a little more pregnant in Iraq. Right after initially promising no more boots on the ground, he's up to 1,600. It'll be over 10,000 by the time his term in office ends. Jimmy Carter was very critical of the president for not putting for being allergic to boots on the ground in Iraq. When Jimmy Carter is saying that your foreign policy is not robust enough,
that's true. When he's taking time to stop building houses for the needy,
The best former president we've ever had.
Yeah, Jimmy but also Carter. The most loudmouth. There's actually a great book called The President's Club, and one of the recurring themes of that is the degree to which Jimmy Carter has a tendency to speak out of turn.
He cares.
I've got to tell you, those Naval Academy guys, they're like that.
I think, you know, a larger sort of theme that you're drawing out here, which we had Robert D. Kaplan on the show, who wrote a very, very nice blurb on the back of
Bob Kaplan, he is a mensch. What a gentleman.
Yeah, he is. And he, one of the points that he really made when he talked to us is, you know, we have to get past the idea that, you know, foreign policy operates on the timeline of Twitter. Like, foreign policy is done over generations.
It's like eating soup with a knife.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Thank you.
You see how I bring it back around, DT? Keep going, though. You're fixing. You just fixed
so
Afghanistan. You fixed
Iraq. Next is Syria, right?
Let's go Syria, and then I want Pakistan.
And then Pakistan. So Syria's harder because we don't know who we want to win.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? So Assad is a murderer. Who uses chemical weapons against his own people. He is a bad guy. The only thing worse than Assad is, of course, ISIS, which you know, literally sells women and girls into sexual slavery.
But in the name of the Quran.
But in the name of the Quran.
The perverted.
I've checked. The Quran does not say any of that stuff.
No, it does not. That's Ibn Wahhab. That's his 16th century. That, talk about another sociopath.
He and Mao would have a lot to talk about.
Oh, they sure would. Great guys.
So the real problem in Syria is not destroying ISIS. It's that destroying ISIS means that Assad takes over again. Mm-hmm. And we've got to decide whether we're willing to live with that outcome, which is, you know, not necessarily one I recommend, but the alternative is a long-term occupation of Syria in the wake of the defeat of ISIS.
But isn't, when you say Assad, we're really talking about less the this guy Assad, and maybe more the general apparatus, the regime of Syria. Isn't there a way to create an incentive structure for that regime that says, listen, you come into the fold here, man. Aren't you guys tired of being pariahs?
Hope for a coup? Certainly, we've done that before. You may remember the case of Ziem.
Or tame the beast. I mean, or say, is Saddam, I mean, is Assad really that... Is he like Saddam Hussein, or is he just the head of an apparatus that is that way because they're holding on to power?
I'm going to let you speak in favor of Assad. I won't go that far.
No, I won't.
What I will say is this is a, and it doesn't help now, but another place Panetta has been critical of President Obama has been that we actually had a third choice back in the summer of 12. There were moderate rebels, moderate Syrian rebels, who we could have supported, who then CIA Director Petraeus, then Secretary of State Clinton, then SecDef Panetta, all encouraged the president to support as a sort of a third way. Those guys are all dead now, or almost all dead now.
Really, all the moderates.
The moderates in a chaotic situation, the most ruthless are the ones who survive.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And so it should be no surprise that the guys who compose ISIS have killed off most of those moderate rebels. And so we really truly have no good options in Syria at this point. I think we had a reasonable option in Syria in the summer of 12. The president chose not to support them. My own personal belief, because he didn't want to get involved, be seen getting involved in another war in the Middle East prior to his second term election.
Politics.
Right. It's all, well, ultimately, politicians do, in fact, do politics.
I do sympathize with his decision, though, because let's be honest. Yes, they were maybe moderates, but
they were still bad guys.
Yeah, or whoever they were. I mean, we just didn't know enough about the guys on the ground. We didn't know enough about the insurgency.
I don't disagree with that, but that window closed.
Yeah.
And as a result, we really have no good options left now in Syria. And my guess is that what's going to end up happening, because ISIS is so horrible, is that you're probably right. We're going to come to some sort of accommodation with Assad. But, right, the second and third order effects, what does that tell the people of the Middle East? In terms that the United States is willing to cooperate with dictators who gas their own people after drawing red lines against them, right, as President Obama did, said if you cross this red line, you're going down, and then we changed our mind. So the much of the motivation behind the Islamist uprisings and desire to kill Americans and the whole motivation behind this has been that we support some very repressive regimes in
Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm. for instance,
which is an extremist Sunni, country, and not very democratic, but they are they're real nice to us.
So. They are very nice to us, and they provide the gasoline that you used on the drive into work today.
Well, you can understand the Arab street thinking that the United States foreign policy is very hypocritical. That's always been the complaint.
I think right, they have a reasonable point there.
Yeah.
But they will have an even stronger point if we end up collaborating with Assad against the Islamic State and de facto, that's what we're doing when we bomb ISIS inside Syria.
And in fact, I mean, again, like to go back to the whole point of counterinsurgency, in doing that, we may end up creating even bigger problems for ourselves down the line.
Absolutely right. And we've done the unnecessary invasion of Iraq in 2003, the bungled occupation that followed, the unnecessary and premature withdrawal of all American troops from Iraq in 2011, have all created a generations worth of problems in the Middle East for American foreign policy. These problems are not going to go away. The only thing that's worse is Pakistan, the most rapid builder of nuclear weapons, the most rapidly increasing nuclear weapons inventory in the world, the worst proliferator of nuclear technology to rogue regimes in the world, afflicted by a number of insurgencies inside its own borders, including the remnants of Al-Qaeda Central, with a very, very fragile government. Pakistan is the most dangerous country in the world for the United States. We are enormously fortunate that drones have enabled us to essentially defeat Al-Qaeda Central inside Pakistan without having to mount a ground invasion of Pakistan.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. And you're speaking, when you speak of Pakistan, are you speaking about Waziristan and that lawless area between Afghanistan
and Pakistan? Bin Laden was 5 miles from Pakistan's version of West Point.
Yes, he was. I wonder if they knew he was there.
They are either incompetent beyond belief.
Yeah.
Or
they were getting a lot of money. They were getting a lot of money from the United States to fight terrorism.
And they were also getting, it is possible to believe, lots of money from Saudi Arabia, bin Laden, a Saudi national, to protect.
I'm shocked. I am shocked and outraged at this kind of behavior in geopolitics. I mean, is there no morality or ethics? No, I'm being silly, but I mean, it is. It just I forgot and didn't realize that Pakistan was that much of a nuclear power. Their check, of course, is India. I mean,
India, honestly, the irony here, Pakistan is terribly worried about India. India actually couldn't care less about Pakistan. What India cares about is China.
Mm-hmm.
And so Pakistan is arming itself to the teeth, concerned about the Indians, including building terror groups that it employs all too often, both inside Afghanistan and inside India. Pakistan has a serious inferiority complex and some real deeply, deeply troubling psychoses as a country, and it is going to continue to be an enormous problem for generations to come.
Well, and here's the interesting...
So what do we do, though? I mean,
So we're actually managing that reasonably well. The long-term answer in all of these countries is education and economic development.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the soft power themes that we've been talking about, there is no military answer, and we have to be careful with our drone strikes, which have been hugely effective in decapitating, dismantling al-Qaeda's central core leadership inside Pakistan. But we have to make sure that we haven't reached the point of diminishing returns there, that we're not creating collateral damage and killing innocent people and creating more insurgents, more terrorists, the next generation.
Well, when you've got a country like Pakistan where I think 8 families own 90% of the land, and you know, you've got to be in the military to own anything. You know, these problems sound...
Well, but I mean, that's the point, is people feel disenfranchised from the society. And once they feel disenfranchised, you know, if I'm not going to be included in the society, why not build a new society? Why not rebel against the one that exists?
Correct. So insurgencies always happen in countries that have corrupt, not very capable governments. As Americans, we should understand this, of course, because this country emerged from an insurgency against then the greatest power in the world, the British Empire.
Hunter's always stopping me because I tend to, you know, I'll tend to say, these bad guys, we got to do this, and I want to get in there with a knife, and let's kill these guys, or let's get these guys out of the way. And Hunter's always quick, and your books and your work are always, you know, quick to remind me that this is asymmetrical, that in fact, soft power is so important in these circumstances, giving people dignity, giving people something to lose, is so important, because most people want say in who governs them. I don't care where you're from. I don't care what your religion is. And everybody wants a better life for their children. Yes, there are sociopaths. Yes, there are bad guys out there, but they're easier to isolate. But the fence sitters, as I think Tom Ricks calls them, is that who wrote the book? Fiasco. Those are the people we have to, the vast majority of moderate people who just want to get on with their life and eat a sandwich. Those are the people that that soft power is most effective with, and that's our biggest weapon, then, you're saying.
That's absolutely right. And this is part of the reason why I titled my new book Knife Fights rather than Gunfights. But there are still people who need to be killed. We still need to use military power, but we should do it precisely from as close a range as possible, mm-hmm. and making killing or harming as few innocent people as possible.
You mean we shouldn't just napalm and Agent Orange everyone and then maybe just go and do some, you know...
Jungle bashing?
Yeah, yeah.
It will only mean that you will have more business in years to come talking about more wars on this entertaining and instructive and very enjoyable radio program.
Well, you're a good man, sir. You know, the book is called Knife Fights. The other book is called Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife. Lessons from the
counterinsurgency lessons from Malaya and Vietnam.
Thank you very much, Hunter.
And actually, to be really accurate, it's the other way around. It's counterinsurgency lessons from Malaya and Vietnam, learning to eat soup with a knife, as you cover in the book. That was the publisher's choice, not
what
yours.
A bad idea.
Yeah.
What a bad idea.
Yeah,
I mean,
Lieutenant.
Really, talk about burying the lead, right?
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
Well, DT, deep thinking, Lieutenant Colonel, retired, headmaster,
doctor. Don't forget the doctor.
Doctor Rhodes. scholar and not a bad looking man. Got a full head of
Thanks
hair.
Thanks for noticing. Thanks for noticing.
And,
I appreciate that.
And a strong jaw. I mean, the man serves his country. I mean, listen, I say John A. Noggle for president. That's what I say. Now
I'm not sensing a groundswell of support out there.
Well, there is in this room.
Yeah,
there is in this room.
And this is the mother of all podcasts.
And Brian is incredibly influential. Never underestimate.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll be recommending this book to a lot of people, both these books. Your work is very, very important. You make the world a better place, sir. And I really hope for all of our sakes that the people in power read your
and
books
I hope
not
that the
once
people,
but twice.
I really hope that the people read your books not once but twice, because that's the thing is, you know, if the people are clear on how foreign policy should be conducted, then the leaders will respond.
There it is.
And it's a wonderful system.
Yep. Yeah. And by the way, if you like stand-up comedy, apparently I'm the best there is. And I don't know where you live, but I'll be in Atlanta, ladies and gentlemen, October 16th, 17th, 18th, the Atlanta Improv. Where do you reside, sir?
I'm in Haverford, Pennsylvania. I will actually, on those dates, be in Washington, D.C. My book launch is the night of the 16th at the Willard Hotel, and the night of the 17th, I'm at Politics and Prose Bookstore.
It's
in our
great
nation's great capital.
All right, well,
great bookstore.
Well, if I'm ever in your neck of the woods, I'm going to email you, and you will have red carpet treatment and first row seats.
I would enjoy that very much.
You won't learn a thing, but I will make you laugh very hard for at least an hour and 20 minutes. So there it is. Thank you very much, sir.
A lot of fun, guys.
All right, John A. Noggle.
Thank you so much for writing
a warrior, a warrior, a scholar, and a gentleman.
Yeah.
All right. Run for president. That's the last thing I have to say to you.
Thanks,
onward,
guys.
Onward. Later.
See you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
A good man.
Great
a
man.
A good man and a smart man. That's a deep thinker. I'm a hothead, so I've got a lot of opinions. This podcast is mellowing me a little bit.
I think it's sharpening you like a knife, Brian.
Thank you for bringing it back to the theme.
Yeah.
But when you talk to people who've spent that much time in a room reading everything and really trying to get to the core of the issue and really taking this problem very seriously and really looking at every layer and every detail. And, you know, you come back to, you know, you can come back to these books and you can realize that you could title these books, Give Your Enemy Dignity, Give the People Dignity, give them what they've lost, treat them with dignity, and you'll get a lot further.
You could even bring it back even further and just remember that it's all about the idea that all men are created equal. Because really, that's what it comes down to, is that, you know, your enemy is a human being. And at the point at which you think of them just as a statistic, then you no longer have access to your greatest weapon, which is the fact that you have shared psychology, and that if you look at yourself and you understand how you think and what your drives are, then, you know, that's the best intelligence you can get. You can really understand what drives them.
Fox News may disagree with you, but I know the Founding Fathers would agree with you. So, ladies and gentlemen,
did you know the Founding Fathers?
I'm older, but I do intuitive work and I communicate with the dead.
Oh, that's cool.
And I have a lot of cash.
What's Thomas
Jefferson
like?
I have a lot of cash laying around my house, so I talk to those faces. I can't go into that right now. We don't have time. Ladies and gentlemen, another amazing podcast brought to you by Brian the Kid Callen, Hunter the Brain Motz, or Tailpiece Motz, and the beautiful Rena Marie. Peace! See me do stand-up.
But also, peace is an appropriate way to end this.
Oh, yeah.
Peace! Peace!
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.